Rabbi, thank you for inviting me back here for the second time. What I want to discuss today briefly is the what I call the Obibi epic as we're going to the elections, right? The relationship between Obama and Netanyahu as we're going to the elections, both here and in Israel. And just to show you how swiftly things move, I left Israel last Friday. And when I left, the elections were a rumor. You know, there might be elections, there might not be elections. Sunday, elections were key. We're going to elections in Israel on September 4th, which will tie into the elections here, and I'll get to that in just a minute. Any discussion about President Obama and Israel brings to mind Groucho Marx's insightful comment, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes? Right? Because as we approach these elections, the Jewish community will be bombarded by those who say, on the one hand, that Obama is a Muslim anti-Semite, and those on the other hand will say, well, you know what, he's actually the first Jewish president we've ever had. So who do you believe? Who do you believe? You believe me, the person who says he's an anti-Semite, or anti-Israel, or your own eyes when you see that he's taken a number of actions and made different statements that actually belie that? Right? Well, who do you believe? You believe me, the person who says he's always has and always will have Israel's back? Or your own eyes, when you see that he's done certain things and taken certain actions that doesn't necessarily support that premise? Things in life, right, are obviously never cut and dry, never completely clear. And what I want to do over the next few minutes is just kind of give put Obama's record on Israel in some kind of perspective. Put his relationship with the Prime Minister in some kind of context. And I realize I'm treading here on explosive ground, dealing with an issue that elicits intense emotions. Right? So drawing on all my experience, I'm the diplomatic correspondent at the Post, at the Jerusalem Post, I'm going to try to be as diplomatic on this as possible. In general, I think you can divide the relationship between Bibi and Obama into three distinct periods. There's the first period, the rocky days, right, from the elections in 2008 up until April, May 2010, following Joe Biden's catastrophic visit to Israel and the announcement of building a new neighborhood in Jerusalem. You have the tone-down days from June 2010 until September 2011, when President Obama went to the UN and finally gave the speech that we wanted to hear. And then you have the honeymoon period, which is from September 2011 up until today. I want to start with the rocky days, okay, because, I mean, chronologically, that's where we begin. The original tension that everybody felt was, of course, not a surprise, right? Because, indeed, after Obama and Bibi was elected, it was clear that there would be tension, because what happened? America goes to the polls and they vote in a president to the left of his predecessor. Israel goes to the polls and votes in a prime minister to the right of his predecessor. So when you move the pillars of a bridge outward, we have an architect here, you move the pillars of a bridge outward, there's going to be tension on the bridge itself. Right? And so that's what we saw. But it would be disingenuous to say that the initial tension was just a case of some pressure on the U.S.-Israeli bridge. The tension was considerable. And I think it revealed several fundamental conceptual differences between how Netanyahu and Obama viewed the world, right? Basic fundamental differences in worldview. The first, at least in the beginning of Obama's term, had to do with the region. I don't know if you remember back when he first came into office, there was this big debate. What do you do first? Who do you deal with first? Do you deal with the Palestinians first? Or do you deal with the Iranians first? Right? Our position was deal with Iran first, because if you can deal with the Iranian issue, it makes everything else easier. Obama's position was no, first deal with the Palestinians, because if we can solve the Palestinian issue, then we can get all the Arab countries to move in and act on Iran. But then what happened is you had WikiLeaks. Remember WikiLeaks? WikiLeaks came out. What do we see in WikiLeaks? We saw in WikiLeaks that the main thing that the Arabs themselves were concerned about wasn't the Palestinians, but rather it was about Iran. So I think you started to see a shift in the administration's position on that. The second major conceptual difference had to do with how do you solve the Israeli-Palestinian issue. With the U.S., when Obama came in, very much still locked into the idea, land for peace. Israel gives up land, and it's going to have peace in return. And Israel, kind of burnt by that paradigm over the last 15 years, not exactly there. And that also created a degree of tension. America was still, when Obama came into power, he still had this idea that you can solve the conflict like this. You're going to come up with an agreement and solve the conflict. And Israel, the Israeli public, is not there anymore as a reaction to what we've gone through during the Second Intifada. I also think that the Americans have moved a little beyond that conception as well. I think they've been frustrated a great deal by what happened when the Palestinians did not use the 10-month settlement freeze in order to bring anything forward. And in an interview I had with the U.S. ambassador to Israel, Dan Shapiro, he talked less about a couple weeks ago. He talked less about huge diplomatic breakthroughs and more about just kind of trying to keep the situation as stable you can in this very unstable region. So I think there was an evolution of American policy on that as well. I think that one of President Obama's first missteps had to do with his outreach to the Arab world. When he came into office, remember, he wanted to outreach to the Muslim world. It's important for us that the U.S. has a good relationship with the Arabs, right? That's good for us. A strong American position in the Arab world is important for us. But I think what happened in the beginning, you know, remember he went to Saudi Arabia, he went to Turkey, he went to Cairo. He didn't come to us for a cup of coffee. Okay, he's a busy guy. You can get over that. But still, it left a feeling of why not. But when he went to Cairo, he gave an important speech. It was a speech. It was his big outreach to the Muslim world. And in that speech, he said some good things about Israel. But he also said something that was incredibly jarring to the Israeli ear. And that was, and I'm paraphrasing, essentially buying into the Arab narrative that Israel exists because of the Holocaust. Right? Excuse me, Israel doesn't exist because of the Holocaust. The Holocaust shows you why you need Israel. But Israel, you know, Zionism predated the Holocaust by some 70 or 80 years. When he said that, it sent kind of a message to the Israelis that this guy doesn't really know where we're coming from. He doesn't get us. He doesn't get us in his kishkas. And that's something important. Though bad, I don't think that was his worst misstep. His worst misstep was his decision that the settlements were the key to everything. That if you just solve the settlement issue, you're going to unlock the door to peace in the Middle East. Everyone knows about Obama's demand to stop all settlements everywhere, including in Jewish neighborhoods in Jerusalem built after the 67 war, which we don't view as settlements, but the Europe and now the U.S. does. When he adopted this policy, what happens is he just chased the Palestinians up the tree, right? Because they, up until this point, they were willing to negotiate with Israel even though there was construction of the settlements. Once the President of the United States of America said this, what are they going to do? They're going to be more Catholic than the Pope, right? If he says no settlements, they're going to actually negotiate. So I think that, you know, it gave them an excuse not to negotiate, which is exactly where we're at right now. There hasn't been negotiations for the most part in the last 3 years. I think a couple of elements went into Obama's decisions at this point. First was the people he surrounded himself with. First and foremost, Rahm Emanuel, remember the former chief of staff, who served in Clinton's presidency, and believe me, he had a belly full of Bibi. I mean, he brought a lot of baggage with him against Netanyahu from the time that he was in the Clinton presidency. And he believed that from the very outset, from the very beginning, it was necessary to put Netanyahu in his place. And so he took a very strident position on the settlements. The settlement issue led to something else, which for us was very problematic. It led to Obama essentially denying that there were any understandings between Israel and the U.S. regarding where settlement construction could take place when it was clear that such agreements existed under the Bush administration. What does that mean? There was a famous letter that George Bush sent to Ariel Sharon before we left Gaza, in which he said essentially that the U.S. accepts the position that the borders aren't going to go back to 67, that the large settlement blocks would be contained within Israel, and that the Palestinian refugees would not come back into Israel. Obama, Hillary Clinton, they said they don't recognize the formality of this letter. And this made Israelis ask how it could be expected, how we could be expected to uphold agreements when the U.S. itself was not upholding agreements that formed the basis for Ariel Sharon's decision in 2005, a very traumatic decision to leave Gaza. It made Obama look rather untrustworthy in the eyes of the Israeli public, and it strengthened the sense that he was making on us unreasonable demands. And this all peaked in March of 2010 with Vice President Joe Biden's visit and the announcement, the mistaken announcement, it was a bad move on our part, that they were going to build a new neighborhood in Jerusalem, right, in a place called Ramat Shlomo. And this caused a fierce reaction from Washington. The overheated reaction included a dressing down by Hillary Clinton on the phone that lasted for 45 minutes. It led to the State Department spokesman linking the U.S.-Israeli relationship, linking it to the pace of the peace process with the Palestinians, which was unheard of. Right? There was a sudden introduction into the U.S. debate of the idea that Israel's actions were actually endangering U.S. troops abroad and were costing a lot of money. One spokesman said it's costing us blood and treasure. Right? It led to Netanyahu, as y'all remember, being treated rather shabbily in the White House. They had a late night meeting. There was no cameras. It was shabby treatment. Ambassador, Israel's ambassador to the U.S., Michael Oren, is not an alarmist, and he's not a guy who's prone to panic. He reportedly called this the worst ebb in U.S.-Israeli ties in 35 years since 1975, when Gerald Ford threatened a reassessment of the whole relationship. And then, almost as sudden as it came, the tone started to change as Obama began to feel blowback from supporters saying that he'd gone too far, and that while it might be okay for the U.S. to have some daylight, or for the U.S. to show that there's some daylight between Jerusalem and Washington, this wasn't just some daylight what we were seeing, this was high noon. Right? When Charles Schumer, the New York senator from the senator from New York, a huge Obama supporter and also a staunch supporter of Israel, when he spoke out publicly, when he went on the radio, a Jewish radio station in New York, and said that, "Mr. President, you're pushing too hard, too fast," the administration took notice, right? Because if he was saying it, it meant there was a problem. And a charm offensive was launched that included meetings between Rahm Emanuel and Dennis Ross with rabbis. There were two delegations of rabbis that went to meet him in May of 2010. There was a luncheon, presidential luncheon with Elie Wiesel, right? And there was even Obama met with the U.S. Jewish members of Congress, and he admitted there that, well, you know, the tone was a bit problematic, and he said, "We got some of our toes blown off." What happened? Why was this sudden change of heart and tone? And remember, this was the summer of 2010, a few months before the congressional elections. And at that point, the administration was concerned because of all this tone up until then. It was concerned simply about losing the Jews. Not necessarily losing the Jewish voters, but the Jewish contributors to the Democratic Party. Right? The Jews make up a huge percentage of those who give big money to the Democrats. The Hill, a Washington-based newspaper that covers Congress and political campaigns, quoted sources as saying that Jews make up 25 to 50% of those who give $25,000 or more in each election cycle. Right? Now, while Israel is obviously not a major issue for the majority of those contributors, if it's a determining factor for even 5 or 10%, that's a significant amount of money for people who run in for Congress. Right? Even Chaim Saban, who's a major Democratic contributor, major Democratic donor, right? He made statements saying that he was going to withhold his support for Obama. And indeed, when Obama got clobbered in the congressional elections in 2010, Jews voted far less in that election for the Democrats than they voted for Obama in 2008. 2008, Jews voted, according to the poll, 78% for Obama. In the congressional elections in November of 2010, Jews voted 66% for the Democrats. That's a 12% drop that's not necessarily insignificant. And following the 2010 elections, there was concern in Israel, right? We had real concern that once the elections were over, we were going to go back to the bad old days, to the tone that existed before then. There's an aphorism that you've probably heard, and it says, "The odd years are good for the Palestinians, the even years are good for good for Israel and good for the Jews, because the even years are the election years." And we were entering 2011, which was an odd year, and there was a great deal of concern in Jerusalem. But it didn't happen. The tone didn't revert back to what it was beforehand, and you have to ask yourself the question, why not? Why not? I think there's a couple reasons. First of all, the departure of Rahm Emanuel and David Axelrod had a positive influence on the tone of ties. Again, Rahm Emanuel had a lot of baggage he carried with him regarding Netanyahu, and he was a problematic factor in that relationship. Also the departure of George Mitchell and the emergence of Dennis Ross as the key Middle East voice, that was good for us. Also the appointment of Dan Shapiro in the summer of 2011 as the U.S. ambassador to Israel was a good move and sent a positive signal to Israel. Shapiro is a committed Jew who himself once considered Aliyah, right? He embodies all those sentiments towards Israel, empathy, sympathy, and understanding that Obama, according to his critics, lacks. He was sent in Israel, I think he was sent to Israel for one reason, and that's to shore up Obama's standing among Israelis with the hope that this would then bounce back to the American Jewish community. And his entire stint since he's been there has been one of trying to radiate a sense of support and sympathy and understanding for Israel. Another reason I think that the tone did not revert back to what it was the Palestinian failure to take advantage of the settlement freeze. Right? Remember that 10-month settlement freeze? It was unheard of in Israeli politics. The media story, of course, was always about the tension between Israel and the U.S. because that's news, right? That's a man bites dog. That's something that the press is going to focus on. And as much as the White House was frustrated with Netanyahu, they were also frustrated with the Palestinians and the Arabs for not taking advantage of the settlement freeze and running with it and actually doing something with it. They would have liked to see Netanyahu extend the freeze, right? But when they didn't, there was a degree of understanding. And the final reason that things didn't go back to what they were was the Arab Spring, right? The Arab Spring. The Arab Spring just completely changed everyone's focus from Israel and the Palestinians to Tunisia, then Bahrain, then Egypt, Yemen, Libya, Morocco, and now Syria. The Israeli-Palestinian issue today is not a major item on the agenda. It changed the focus in Washington. They had to worry about other things, not necessarily us. So even, you know, even though maybe Obama wanted to push the issue, it just wasn't the main center of his attention. And I call this the tone-down period. And I think it was a period when the tone was tampered down considerably. It wasn't necessarily free of all problems. Right? You did have problems. In May of 2011, before the AIPAC meeting, President Obama talks about Israel's need to return to the 67 borders, which was the first time that that's happened. And then you had that famous meeting in the White House, which they call it the lecture, in which Netanyahu kind of lectured the president on why this couldn't happen. It was interesting, though, that the president didn't respond. And I think that's also, you know, we were in this period of trying to tone down and tamper down the tension. And then we enter what we call now, what I call, and I think we're in this period now, the honeymoon. The honeymoon period started in September 2011, when President Obama stood up and gave the most pro-Israel speech of his tenure at the United Nations, a speech that we waited 3 years to hear. Remember, this was an important speech because this was when the Palestinians went to the UN in order to try to get them to recognize their statehood. He gave a speech there in which he articulated Obama, not Shapiro, Obama articulated empathy and sympathy for our concerns and our overall situation. He talked about our link to the land, right? This is the speech the man should have given in Cairo. If he'd given this speech in Cairo, the relationship would have gotten off on a much better footing from the get-go. It took some 34 months, but at the UN, Israel finally heard the speech from Obama that we wanted to hear. Gone were so many elements of previous Obama statements and speeches in the Middle East that rankled so many Israelis and left a taste in our people's mouths that this was a president who simply did not get us, who didn't understand our history, our daily concerns, or our security fears. Gone was any reference at all in that speech to the settlement. Gone were veiled comparisons he made before between the Palestinian struggle and the U.S. civil rights movement, as was done in Cairo. Gone was also this striving after perfect balance, talking about the Holocaust in one breath, as he did in Cairo, and then saying in the very next breath, and I quote, "On the other hand, it's also undeniable that the Palestinian people, Muslims and Christians, have suffered in pursuit of a homeland." No, this speech was entirely different, had a different tone and a different tenor. This is what he said in that speech. He said, "Let's be honest with ourselves. Israel is surrounded by neighbors that have waged repeated wars against it." He said, "Israel's children come of age knowing that throughout the region, other children are taught to hate them. Israel, a small country of less than 8 million people, look out at the world, leaders of much larger nations as they threaten to wipe it off the map." Right? This was an indication that he changed his tone dramatically, and he was willing to articulate an understanding of our plight. This speech ushered in that honeymoon area, that honeymoon era. And some will say that it was merely because of the elections, right? Now, when was the speech delivered? The speech was delivered about 2 weeks after a pro-Israeli Jewish candidate, a religious Jewish candidate, a Democrat, lost the elections in a very Jewish district in New York. I actually ate dinner with this guy last Friday night in New York. He's a from Jew, very committed to Zionism, very committed to Israel, right? He could be, you know, he's one of us. This guy lost. He lost in a very Jewish district in New York, and this sent alarm bells ringing in the administration, because if this guy could lose in a Jewish district, something was wrong. Something was wrong. And that kind of ushered in this golden era in ties. Not that they're not problems, right? Now, there are problems in the relationship, foremost being differences sometimes aired too publicly by anonymous officials about Iran. But most of the problems are handled differently. They're handled in public. Right? In the beginning, what you saw was you saw megaphone diplomacy. Obama had a problem with Israel. He didn't work it out in the back rooms or through diplomatic channels. He took it outside to the public, and that kind of created a difficult situation. That is behind us, and now, right, I think we're in the golden era. What does it mean to be in the golden era in the relationship with Obama? It means Obama has jettisoned his early and faulty policy of trying to curry favor with the Arabs by publicly distancing the U.S. from Israel, largely, I think, because it didn't work. When he came into power, he thought that if he distanced himself, the Arabs would give something to Israel and that we could reach some kind of agreement. In the beginning, he asked Saudi Arabia to make the incredible concession of letting Israeli jets fly over Saudi airspace on the way to India, right? A great concession, and the Saudis were unwilling to do that. I think, you know, he wanted to curry favor with the Muslim public, but along with his failure to close down Guantanamo Bay or continue using drone strikes against Muslims around the world, he wasn't able to win the Muslims over to his side, even though he publicly distanced himself from Israel. The golden era means that he stopped placing all the onus of responsibility for the Steinmeier peace process on Israel, and he realized that the Palestinians were at least equally obstructive. I heard last week that Tony Blair is the quartet envoy he's the envoy of the quartet to the Middle East, a pro-Israel guy, by the way, and he said something that I think reflects also the attitude in Washington. He said that after months of all this haggling, you have a situation where Israel will scream and shout and bite and kick and holler and yell, but in the end, they will be willing to reach an agreement. He said the Palestinians will say that they're willing to reach an agreement, but in the end, they won't implement that agreement. And if that's the attitude that Blair has, I think it's pretty much also right now the attitude which is probably extant in the White House. This golden era means that Obama has scaled back his expectations of conflict resolution to conflict management. And I think this is an important thing. One of the problems we have in Israel, we no longer really believe that you're going to snap your finger, peace now will happen, and you're going to resolve the conflict. We're at a place that says, we just got to manage it. We're not going to solve it overnight. There's too many things involved. Manage it. And I think that the administration went from the beginning thinking that he could solve it, Obama thought he could solve it, to now realizing, forget it, ain't going to happen, the best you can do is manage it. And this golden era, of course, will last until the elections. His off-the-mic comments to Medvedev, right, to the Russian President Medvedev in March, that he's going to be more flexible after the elections, believe me, they were definitely heard it loud and clear in Jerusalem, and are obviously a cause for concern. Though the concern that after a possible election victory, Obama will be much tougher on us far predated those comments that he made to Medvedev. Even as there were concerns about 2011, right, the odd year, there are now obviously concerns about 2013. With those concerns, however, I think it's important to keep a couple things in mind. First, while the president is powerful on foreign policy, he's not an autocrat. Right? He may not need to be reelected, but Congress does. And both houses of Congress are extremely supportive of Israel and concerned about Jewish voters and, more importantly, about Jewish donations. Politics does not end when a president gets reelected. Right? Second-term presidents are still subject to pressure from Congress, and they realize that if they pick fights with Congress on issues that are important to them, it could weaken his ability to get issues that he wants done through Congress. Secondly, I think he's going to be unlikely to be willing to weather the political cost if he's not sure that it's going to be worth it and that things are ripe on the ground for change. Right? You're only going to go after pushing forward a peace agreement if you think that the situation is ripe on the ground for a peace agreement to be reached. And right now, right, you have enormous uncertainty in the region. You have Gaza still in the hands of an unrepentant Hamas. I think that Obama or his administration realizes that things are not exactly ripe on the ground right now to reach an agreement. It's fair to say that Obama will calculate the odds, right, of success and failure. Some say that the man is going to be shooting for his legacy. Right? Every second-term president begins to worry about his legacy, how he's going to be remembered, and there's no better way to ensure your legacy, perhaps, than to bring about peace in the Middle East. But you also don't want to shoot for a legacy item if it might fail. Right? You're not going to bet your wad on something that could fail. And I think that to a large extent, Obama realizes, like I said, that the situation right now is not ripe for great success. Things have changed because of the Arab Spring considerably. Right? People say now that Egypt perhaps is a bigger threat to Israel than Iran. Israel, which might once have been willing to remove troops from the Jordan Valley because we have a peace treaty with Jordan, we're not there anymore because we have no idea what's going to happen in Jordan. And finally, I think a second-term president's impact, his impact on world leaders begins to fade as each day passes. Right? In 2014, if the president turns to the Arab world and asks them to make some gestures to Israel, you can forget about it because they're going to say, I don't owe this guy anything. He's going to be out in 2 years. I'll wait until I see who the next president is and I'll deal with him. So his impact on both Israel, by the way, and on the Arabs begins to decline as the days pass. Which brings me now to the overall scorecard. Right? When summing up the relationship, I think a couple of points are worth making. First, it's no secret, I'm not giving you any great chidushim here, this is no big news, the men didn't click, right? Netanyahu and Obama didn't click. There wasn't that proverbial chemistry. Look, I'm no expert on body language, right? There's a gentleman sitting here with his arm folded, I don't know if he's mad or cold, or I can't read that. And I know that I covered Obama in the White House, Bibi, when he went to the White House in March. And I sat in the Oval Office where they moved the press into the Oval Office when they had their statements. And a lot of people talked about the cold body language. I don't know about that. But I do know that what you had there was it was completely businesslike. Like they sat in their chairs, they brought in the press. Generally, there's some kind of banter. You know, you talk about golf, you talk about the weather, you talk about something to kind of ease into it. There was none of that. It was all businesslike. It was from the minute they brought the press in, boom, they were talking about the things that they wanted to get across. And I think that shows something. I think it shows, you know, the tenor of the relationship. It defined the tenor of the relationship wasn't chummy, it was all businesslike. Now, some people, like former UN ambassador, Israeli's former UN ambassador, Dori Gold, will say that personal relationships are not that important. And then the final analysis of what matters is interest, and that Israel and the U.S. have common interests that go beyond whether the two leaders actually like each other. And while I agree with that to a certain extent, I won't underestimate the value added of personal relationships, right? I mean, just think of yourself. These are people like we are. Think if you're doing business with somebody you like or doing business with somebody you don't like or don't necessarily trust. It makes things easier if you have a good common relationship. Things can go unstated. Things can more easily be forgiven or forgotten. This is one of the benefits of the Sharon Bush days and the Olmert Bush days, because they had a good, working, friendly relationship with the administration. There was trust and there was understanding. Now, there wasn't always agreement, but it was much easier to deal with the disagreements when there was a good rapport. A good personal rapport, that obviously doesn't exist between Obama and Netanyahu. And at a time when you have a critical issue like Iran on the agenda, it would be beneficial for us if the two leaders, and not only the leaders, but their offices, had a better working relationship. Now, that being said, the Obama campaign is going to make the following arguments to the Jewish voters. Obama, and these arguments are legitimate and true, by the way. Obama has shown through security cooperation and approving funds for the Iron Dome system that he does indeed have Israel's back when it comes to security. The security relationship we have with the president right now is very good. Right? People say it's never been better. Bush got the ball rolling when he signed on for this $30 billion 10-year security agreement. But Obama could have canceled, and he didn't. And the security relationship between the two countries is as good as it's ever been, if not better. He mobilized the international community to take the toughest sanctions to date against Iran. And the president has repeatedly said there is a military option, and taking off the table an idea that, well, you know what, you can contain a nuclear Iran, that you can have mutual assured destruction with Iran like you did with the Soviet Union. He took that off the table, said that that's unacceptable to the U.S. That was important for us. Obama has also consistently been at Israel's side at times when it needed it. Right? He didn't go to Durban conferences, which would have demonized Israel. He supported Israel at the UN in September, kind of taking the wind out of the sails of the Palestinian bid for statehood. He helped get our security guards out of Cairo when they were holed up there in September and facing a lynch mob. He stood with Israel on the Goldstone Report. Remember the Goldstone Report? He backed us there, and he also backed us to a certain degree with the flotilla, the Mavi Marmara incident with the Turks. That's all true. It's all important, and I don't want to minimize it. But as one writer noted, in Israel, it often comes too late. Right? First there was abuse, and then there were flowers. At least in Israel, I'm not sure that the flowers of the last 16 months has washed away the impression left by those first very difficult 2 years in office. Tellingly, I think that the predominant sense in Israel remains one of uncertainty. Right? We're 4 years into Obama tenure, and we don't really know where the guy stands in his heart. It's the famous Kishka test, right? The Kishka test. We in Israel, right, we're insecure. As Jews, we're insecure. We don't want a president who likes us and values us like he likes Taiwan and South Korea, right? We don't want that same kind of friendship. We want love. We want publicly displayed affection. We want him to love us special. We want a public smooch on the mouth, right? And this just hasn't happened with Obama. We want somebody like Bill Clinton, who stood up in the Knesset and said that, you know what, my pastor, who I loved on his dying day, he took me to the side and said, if there's one thing you do as president, don't sell Israel down the river. That's what we want. We want that sense that he likes us in his gut, a sense we got from Clinton and a sense we got from George W. Bush. It's not a sense we've gotten from Obama. Obama has not convinced the Israeli public that he has that feeling, which I think says something. I'm not sure Obama has that feeling, not only for us, but for anything, or for any country, or for anybody. Personally, I don't think Obama, I definitely don't think Obama's anti-Israel. He's definitely not an anti-Semite. I think if you put it in Israeli terms, Obama, if he were an Israeli, he would vote for the left-wing Meretz party, right? And which is legitimate. Meretz is a legitimate Zionistic party. It's on the left. What happened here, though, he's trying to foist that kind of left-wing Israeli ideology on a public that's no longer there. Right? That train has left the station. We've moved past that. That outlook doesn't reflect Israeli society, and I think that's where you see the tension. That's the reason for the tension. And Romney, what about Mitt Romney? Well, Romney has the benefit of really not having much of a track record on foreign relations, including the Middle East. Now, we didn't have a team at the Salt Lake City Winter Olympics. He didn't have to talk about Israel. Right now, he's saying all the right things, and his rhetoric is great. He's going to move. I don't know if he said he's going to move the embassy, but his first trip is going to be to Israel. He's saying all the right things. But just as Obama is saying things right now for the elections, so is Romney. So is Romney. I heard him speak in Israel in 2007 at the Herzliya conference, and he was extremely tough on Iran. I was very impressed by it. But then, too, that was before an elections, and he was posturing for the 2008 elections. Now, the one thing that he does bring to the table, as far as Israel is concerned, is a worldview that is closer to the prime ministers than President Obama. The New York Times, in what I think was a hatchet job trying to stick it to Obama, to Romney, wrote a couple weeks ago about this close, warm, friendly relationship that he developed with Netanyahu when they both worked together at the Boston Consulting Group. Obama went to school at MIT, Romney was working at this consulting group, and they worked together for 6 months. And the New York Times wrote it, and they said a warm, friendly relationship that has continued to this day. And the impression they left there in that article, right, was essentially that, well, you know, Romney's in Bibi's pocket. So you vote Romney, you're getting Bibi. It wasn't exactly an affectionate article towards Romney. Now, what kind of amused me about this thing is that Bibi, 2 weeks ago, gave an interview to CNN, and they asked him about the Romney relationship. And he said, yeah, look, I mean, I know Mitt Romney. I worked for him for 6 months. Then I didn't see him for 30 years. I didn't see him for 30 years until he became the governor of Massachusetts and I became the finance minister. And then obviously when he comes to Israel, we meet. But that's far from being, you know, the best friend forever that the New York Times kind of set this up, kind of the way in which the New York Times characterized that relationship. But like I said at the beginning, Obama and Netanyahu were different pillars, right? I mean, they were different pillars. And because they were so distant, it created a certain tension. Romney and Bibi, their worldview is a lot closer together. So that tension from the get-go, I don't think is going to exist. But I'd also caution not to get carried away, right? Because George W. Bush is widely, and rightfully, I believe, considered a great president for Israel. He was a good president for Israel. But believe me, there were points of tension there. And remember, he didn't exactly go into Iran and take out the nuclear reactor there either. In the final analysis, Israel and the U.S. are two different countries with two different interests that, thank God, often overlap. But at other times, they conflict regardless of who is in the White House. This was true in the past, and it's going to be true in the future if Romney wins as well. The difference is how you deal with the differences. Do you bring them out there? Are they wide open for everybody to see? Or do you deal with them in the back room? As to whom Israel prefers, you're not going to hear, or you should not hear, any hint of preference from Jerusalem. That would be stupid, right? That would be ridiculous. Considering the stakes, that's extremely wide policy. And even though I in no way speak for the government, it's a policy that diplomatically I'm going to adhere to as well. Look, I just want to end by discussing something that's just happened since I left Israel, and the fact that we're now going to elections. Right? We're going to go into elections, and what this means and how this plays into the whole American election scene. When I left Israel, again, a week ago on Friday, there were murmurs of Netanyahu possibly calling new elections. By Sunday, it was a done deal. And we are now, for the 33rd time in 64 years, going to elections. I think they even set the date today at September 4th, which is 2 months earlier than the American elections. And believe me, that's not coincidental. And the question is why? Right? Why is this government, which is pretty stable, this was the most stable government Israel's had since 1988. They just celebrated the third year anniversary, and at that time they were saying this could be the first government since 88, since Yitzhak Shamir, that it's going to actually fulfill its term and run until October of 2013. Then a couple things happened which kind of displaced the apple cart. The first was there was a Supreme Court decision knocking down what's called the Tall Bill. The Tall Bill is a bill that kind of put into a framework whether Haredim, how Haredim go into the army. Supreme Court said this was unworkable, this was not fair, this was unequal. You can't do this anymore. And because Bibi has in his party, in his coalition, both a party, a Haredi party called Shas, and another party called Yisrael Beitenu of Avigdor Lieberman, which wants to get the Haredim into the army, he realized this was going to be a clash. He has to come up with some kind of new framework, and this was going to create a lot of tension and could actually bring down the coalition. Secondly, there was a Supreme Court decision that Israel is going to have to evacuate a couple settlement outposts that were built on Palestinian land. There's also held within it, I think, the kernel of a coalition crisis that could conceivably bring down the government. So Netanyahu sat back, he looked at all that, and he said, why wait? If this is going to bring down the government, if Lieberman is going to bring it down when it's good for him, I'm going to preempt, I'm going to catch everybody pretty much off balance and call the elections when it's good for me, right? Which he's done. He's called the elections in 4 months, which is not a lot of lead time, which is good for him because right now his popularity is at a peak. Right? His approval rate right now is 48%, which in Israel, believe me, that's a miracle. Shaul Mofaz, the head of the Kadima, the guy who took over Kadima after Tzipi Livni, he hasn't picked up any steam in the polls. And this way, Netanyahu also avoids a bruising budgetary battle that would weaken the government, as well as being able to avoid, it's summertime. Just like last summer when you had the cottage cheese revolts and there was all these demonstrations on the street, you're going to see it again this year. But now he doesn't have to worry about it because you can say it's all political. So the timing is actually very smart. And there's another element here that I don't disregard, and that's the Obama factor. That's the Obama factor. Netanyahu, believe me, remembers full well when President Bill Clinton did everything he could, short of taking out an advertisement in the Jerusalem Post in 1996 to defeat Netanyahu and make sure that Shimon Peres won the election. Right? He wanted Peres to get in. He wanted to pave the way for Peres to win that election. Right? Without, again, without saying, vote Peres, what did he do? He called a summit of major international leaders in Sharm el-Sheikh a couple weeks before the election in order to rally support for Peres. He signed an anti-terrorism memorandum with Israel within days in order to show the Israeli public, hey, I like this government, the Peres government. This is the one I want to work for. It didn't work. It backfired, right? Netanyahu won that election. But what Netanyahu, with that in his mind, he wants to neutralize the ability of Obama to do the same thing, right? He wants to keep Obama out of our elections. Obama, believe me, Obama will be less likely to interfere in an Israeli election a couple of months before his own, not wanting to invite then any kind of retribution from Netanyahu. He doesn't want Netanyahu to get involved in the American elections. One of his concerns, obviously, is that there could be an Israeli airstrike in Iran before the elections, which would complicate his election situation a great deal, because you don't know, what that would do, how there would be American involvement. Right now, right, Netanyahu is way ahead of the polls, and it seems a pretty good bet that he's going to win this election. Everybody, I mean, nobody, it's not even a race. Everybody knows that he's going to win the election. The question then becomes, which parties are going to join the coalition and how the different makeup of the coalition is going to affect Israeli policies into the future. Look, that's my overall overview of the relationship of Obama. If you have any questions on this or anything else out there, I'd be happy to take them. Yes?
Today in France, they're having an election with, I guess it's Holland is the guy they figured to win, and Le Pen is also in there, who are anti-Semitic, and they're relationship may change between France and Israel and go maybe more toward France and Arab nations. How would that enter into this whole thing?
Look, it's interesting because unlike in the U.S. where you can ask people after they vote what religion they are and who they voted for, in France, by law, you can't do that. So after the first round of elections a couple of weeks ago, when you set up a situation where it's going to be Sarkozy against Hollande in this election, you really didn't know what the Jews wanted, except in Tel Aviv. Because in Tel Aviv, there's absentee balloting for the French elections. Some 9,500 French Israelis voted. Sarkozy won 85% of those votes. Right? So I think that kind of shows you where the Jews are. Sarkozy, although he said what he said about Netanyahu, he called him a liar, and he doesn't like the settlements, Sarkozy has, to a certain degree, that Kishke element. Right? He does feel something for Israel. And I think that's picked up by the Jews. It's definitely picked up in Jerusalem. I think there's concern. If Sarkozy loses, Israel's going to lose a friend in Europe. Just think back. Compare France under Sarkozy with France under Jacques Chirac, and it's a completely different story. He's taken some positions which are very favorable for us, whereas Chirac was just horrible. Hollande is kind of an unknown actor for us. I mean, I spoke about this to people in the foreign ministry before I left. They said he's a friend, and he's to the right. He's on the right side of the French socialist map, which is good. The problem is you don't know who he's going to surround him with. You don't know who his foreign minister is going to be. I think we're going to pine a bit for Sarkozy, because I think the tone will change. I think they will probably take a more Arab position than they have in the past. Although for France too, the whole Middle East has changed. I mean, Lebanon, they had some great stakes in Lebanon. They felt they had a certain stake in Syria. This is all it's all a new ballgame right now. And I think their interests have changed there as well. They have a certain degree of tension with Turkey, which is good for us, so that we don't, I'm not the only ones you have attention with Turkey. But we're losing a friend with Sarkozy. And if you look, we had a good map not too long ago in Europe, where you had Sarkozy there, you had Berlusconi in Italy. Berlusconi with all his foibles, he was a great friend of Israel. And you had Merkel in Germany. Sarkozy's going down, Berlusconi's out, although this other guy's okay, he's turned out to be okay, this guy, Mario Mofti, I think his name is, he's the Italians are friends, regardless to a certain degree of the government, and the biggest loss will be if Angela Merkel goes, right? Angela Merkel in Germany is a good friend of Israel. Again, she doesn't like Netanyahu, she doesn't like the settlements, but she feels a historic responsibility towards Israel that it's not clear that her successor will feel. So I'm hoping she stays around for a while.
The elections in Egypt, how dangerous is this for Israel in the future?
We know that we're in trouble when the Israeli public is rooting for Amr Moussa, to win the Egyptian presidential election. Amr Moussa is horrible for us. Amr Moussa was Vitra Alek in his anti-Israel rhetoric. He's like Erdogan in Turkey when he was foreign minister and when he was president of the Arab League. He's bad for us. And we're rooting for him, right? So that just shows you the situation. Look, Egypt is a huge problem right now. Egypt, Avigdor Lieberman said in a private conversation with Netanyahu not too long ago that Egypt is a bigger threat to Israel than Iran. And I think there's something to that. We have, because of what's happened in Egypt, we don't know nobody knows what's going to happen in Egypt. Nobody knows where it's going. It doesn't look like it's going in a good direction, right? The peace treaty with Egypt is not going to be the same as if it lasts as it was now. You have a situation where, what's happened since Tahrir Square? You have anti-Israeli, anti-Semitic rhetoric on a daily basis. You have a major terrorist attack in August that was launched not from the West Bank or from Gaza, but from Sinai. You have Grad rockets that fall close to Eilat. You have they've blown up the pipeline about 12 to 14 times. Now you have a situation, natural gas. They used to supply us with natural gas. They were like our biggest supplier of natural gas. 2 weeks ago, they said no more. It's over. Bets are off.
New agreement.
Right. They annulled the agreement. Israel, thank God, since then, we've turned into all of a sudden a natural gas superpower. You know, we've got great gas reserves, which are going to go online, I think, in 2014. So that doesn't affect us that much. But another thing that people don't think about, we have to now rejigger, refocus our whole military conception, because up until this point, you didn't worry about Egypt. Didn't worry about it, right? You had a peace. You didn't have a fence there. It was a wide open border. Your focus was on Lebanon, on Syria. So all the good troops, all the combat, they were all planning for war in Lebanon, and they were trained and they were stationed up there. Now you have to rethink it. Now they're moving troops from there to the south. Israel is building a $1.5 billion fence, huge fence along the Egyptian border. There's a 240-kilometer border. From Kerem Shalom all the way down to Eilat. There was an open border. 2 years ago, right, Israel started to build a fence there, not because of what was going on in Egypt, but because they wanted to keep out African illegal workers who were starting to pour into the country. And Israel's the closest developed economy to Africa, and thousands were coming in, so they said, we got to build a fence. That was very fortuitous that you started building that fence, because now you have a situation where Sinai is kind of the Wild West. There's all kinds of terrorist groups down there. And you're building the fence, and you're going to be able to keep them from coming in. But it's changed our whole strategic thinking. It's a major earthquake. It's a major earthquake, and we're still waiting to see how it plays out.
And they'll support Hamas?
Look, I mean, you've got all kinds of Islamists who are going to, they'll support Hamas or maybe worse. And our leverage over them is very limited. Now, some people will say, well, you know what? They're not going to want to tear up the peace treaty for two reasons. Number one, because the military there is getting a lot of aid from America, and they don't want to lose that aid. But, you know, I hear that argument, and they also say that the military is a bulwark against the Islamists taking over completely. And I look at that argument, and I say, you know what? They said the same thing about Turkey, that the military there was going to keep the secularists in power. Hasn't exactly worked there. And as far as the American aid, I'm not going to base my strategic thinking on thinking that the Egyptian people, the Egyptian government now, for the first time in a long time, has to pay attention to the Egyptian street. The Egyptian street is extremely anti-Israel, even anti-Semitic. Right? They could say, you know, I have Egyptian pride. No, Washington's not going to dictate to me my policy. Look, we saw how Egypt acted with these NGOs when they kept these Americans hostage or for 40 days. You know, you look at that from the outside, it looks nuts. You know, why are they, you know, poking their eyes, poking their fingers in the eyes of America? But there's a degree of pride. You're not going to tell us what to do. So I'm not so secure that just to get that aid, they're necessarily going to dance to Washington's tone.
Apparently there are concerns, reportedly, that the pro-Russian in Congress is building up. Okay, is this a concern, okay, for Jews? Okay.
The pro-Russian in which Congress?
In Congress. Okay, there's a lot of member of Congress, okay, are getting pro, you know, Russian's idea, okay, and that is also shifting shifting the Cold War front, okay, from Europe, okay, to Iran, okay, between Russia and what we want to do in Iran. Okay, it's is this a concern for Jews here?
Look, I mean, our relationship with Russia is fascinating, I think, because if you compare our situation with Russia now to what it was during the time of the Soviet Union, you know, it's night and day. It's night and day. Although Russia, we don't agree with everything Russia does, and they don't agree with everything we do. There's a relationship, and there's a channel of communications. And the Prime Minister goes to Russia once every year or once every 2 years, right? So we have a dialogue. Russia's creating a lot of problems for us in the Middle East right now. Like Syria, you know, Syria is Russia's base in the Middle East. Historically, it's been the case, and they have a naval base there. If Syria goes down, they lose their foothold in the Middle East. They're supporting Syria not necessarily to do us any dirt, right? Their Middle East policy, as opposed to under the Soviets, isn't, I don't think it's being motored by trying to harm Israel as much as it's being motored by trying to harm the U.S., by doing whatever the U.S. isn't doing. That's a fine difference, but it is a difference. Like, Putin isn't an anti-Semite. I don't think Putin wants to lead to the destruction of Israel. I really don't believe that. There's a million Russians in Israel. They cross Germany. You know, the way I come back here to the U.S., business, culture, you have that situation with Russia as well. So the relationship has changed. There's something fascinating. I didn't realize this. The U.S. sends the most tourists to Israel of any country in the world. Right? The second biggest pool of tourists is Russia. Russia. 20 years ago, there wasn't a Russian immigrant, a Russian tourist in the country. And then after Russia, it's Ukraine. If you put Russia and Ukraine together, you have more tourists there, Russian-speaking tourists, than Americans. Right? That's quite a change. And it brings the countries closer together. Again, they cause us a lot of problems with their defense of Syria. Their whole Iranian policy is bad to us. But you don't have this outright hostility to the Jewish state, at least not at Putin's level. You might have it to a certain degree in the foreign ministry, but at Putin's level, you don't have it that you had under the Soviets, and that's changed the situation around considerably. Are we concerned? Yeah, I mean, obviously we're concerned, but Israel doesn't view Russia as an enemy. I don't think Russia views us as an enemy, and there's just all kinds of other interplaying interests that you have to weave through.
I have one question. Do you think we're going to see Obama actually make a visit to Israel, actually put his foot down there?
Yes, I do. Look, George Bush didn't come in his first term. And I think Obama will probably come in his second term as Bush did. Bush didn't come until it was like his sixth year in office. Although for us it was less important because we knew where his heart is. Obama, like I said, we don't know where his heart is. So it would be very helpful, I think, if he came to Israel. I think eventually you'll see him. I mean, if he wins again, I think he'll see him. Look, there's just one thing I want to touch on now, because this is, if I have a few minutes.
Yeah, well, time we have.
Okay, it's Iran. Right? I mean, the big question, obviously, is what Israel is going to do with Iran. And I think when looking at the whole Iranian issue, you have to keep a couple things in mind. First of all, be careful about how much importance you place on what's being said and what's not being said and what's being written and what's not being written. This is an issue which there's very little real knowledge. Right? We don't know what Israel's going to do. Only people who know what Israel's going to do are about three people, right? And believe me, they're not talking. So you have a situation where you have a lot of media speculation. I was amused a bit a few months ago. There was a very learned piece in the New York Times Magazine that went on and on for pages and pages by a guy named Ronen Bergman, who's an Israeli journalist. And his final conclusion, he said, after talking to dozens of Israeli officials, is that there's a 50-50 chance Israel will attack. That's brilliant. 50-50 chance they're going to attack. What that does, though, is it creates a certain buzz, right? This is a subject that people want to read about, they want to talk about, it's out there. But there's very little real knowledge. So what you have is you have speculation like that, or you have a situation where people just, and I know this because I do it myself, because I have to write about Iran. And so you take public statements that officials make and you just parse them to death. Right? You take a statement and you read it like a Talmudic text. What it really means is this, and it could mean this, and this means it. And you're just putting yourself into the process. We saw this about a week and a half ago when Benny Gantz, who's the chief of staff of the army, he said that the Iranians are a rational player. right? And this caused huge news in Israel. I don't know if it caused huge news here, but oh my God, that means that there's a disagreement between him and Netanyahu and him and Barak. And what happened? The guy was in an interview, right? He was asked a question. He says, they've shown signs of rationality in the past. I don't disregard that. Okay, so to take that and to blow it out of proportion and say there's differences is what we do as journalists, because that's all you have to work with. Also, it's true about, you know, the reports that there's huge gaps between Israel and the U.S. on Iran, and that the U.S. sent people to Israel in the early part of the year in order to dissuade them from attacking. We don't know that. We don't know that. We know that there were a lot of visits, right? Tom Donilon was in Israel over a weekend. Right? For all we know, really, he was talking about what the flight path into Iran is. We really don't know. Certain people leak, but those people leak are not necessarily in the inner circle. So keep that in mind when you look at Iran. The second thing I think it's important to think about with Iran is, first of all, Israel has shown historically two things. Number one, that when it does feel that the dagger is against its throat, that its back is against the wall, it's going to act. Right? We did this in 81 with the Iraqis. We did this in 2007 when we took out some kind of Syrian nuclear installation. This was also shown historically that it will take action that it deems necessary for its own existence, even against U.S. opposition. Right? We saw this in 1948 when Ben-Gurion declared the state, even though the State Department was adamantly against it and threatened actions if it did. We saw this in 1967 when Levi Eshkol attacked Egypt, even though LBJ told him, if you go it alone, you're going to be alone. And we saw it in 1981 when Menachem Begin attacked Iraq, even though Ronald Reagan at the time opposed. Okay, so if we feel our back is against the wall, we'll take action, and we'll take action even if it's against American opposition, which doesn't mean we're going to take action now. And doesn't mean necessarily that the action you're going to take is going to be the way it was in Iraq. You never fight the next war like you do the last war. You see something interesting. This Iranian policy, right, or their attempt to go after nukes has been going on since 1995. And Yitzhak Rabin, before he was assassinated, talked about this issue. Right? So this thing's been going on for what? That's 17 years. And believe me, the Iranians are a smart, capable, efficient people. And they haven't been able to achieve their aim, not because they didn't want to, but because things have stopped them from doing it. Right? They're no less efficient than the Pakistanis or the Indians who have nukes. Right? But they haven't been able to do it. And they haven't been able to do it because things have been happening on the ground. I've been following the diplomatic stuff since 2000. And every 2 years since 2000, I go talk to officials, various officials, and say, when are they going to get it? Right? In 2000, they said 2002. Right? In 2002, they said 2004. 2006, 2000, every 2 years. Right? Every 2 years, they've been pushing it off. Until 2010, we had a meeting with the Mayor Dagan, the head of the Mossad, before he quit office, and he said 2015. So at a certain point in time, you come home, you look in the mirror, you look at the wife, and you say, what's going on here? Right? Either they're lying to me, and they were never that close, and they just said this because they want to create a sense of urgency. So I think there was an element to that. Or they've been trying real hard to get it, but they haven't got it because they can't get it because things are happening to keep them from getting what's happening. Straw companies were set up around the world selling them faulty products, right? So that when they spin their centrifuges, they blow up. You have, you know, the famous computer worms. You have assassinations of key scientists to keep them from getting it, with the goal, the strategic aim being kick the can down the road in the hope that in the meantime something will happen inside Iran that will change the regime. And I think I think the U.S. missed the golden opportunity in 2009 when you had those protests on the streets when a million Iranians went out and they didn't get the support from Obama that they needed. And so Obama was new in office, there was a learning curve for whatever reason. I think that was a huge missed opportunity. But I think that overall strategy still exists today. Kick the can down the road, buying yourself time. I think to harbor an illusion that there's going to be one action that's going to knock out this Iranian program, right? That we're going to wake up one morning, today we have this threat, and tomorrow the threat is going to be over. I think that's wishful thinking. I don't think you're going to have that situation. I think this thing has schlepped on for 20 years. Believe me, it can schlep on for another 20 years. I think what you're going to see is you're going to see the Iranians, when the heat gets turned up too hot, they'll step back. And they did this in 2003. 2003, they stopped their nuclear program. This was the only year they've stopped it since 1995. And they stopped it, why? Because they saw that the U.S. had invaded Iraq, and they were worried that they could be next on the chopping block. So they stopped the program. So, I mean, again, it shows a sense of rationality. When the heat gets too hot, they step back. Now you have a situation where the heat is getting turned up again because of the sense of urgency, because of, you know, reports that Israel might attack, or, you know, this whole atmosphere of war that was created, which I think had the benefit of creating a sense of urgency to get the world to finally step in and take serious sanctions. Right? The most serious sanction we saw was the SWIFT banking thing. You know, you want to transfer funds, you have to use SWIFT. So do governments. By cutting them off that system, they've, you know, it's crippled the Iranian ability to move money back and forth. Israel's trying to get this for 3 years, right? They're trying to get this thing down for 3 years, never happened. Now, because of the sort of atmosphere, they finally did it. You have the EU countries. On July 1st, they're going to embargo Iranian oil. But those are serious sanctions that have a bite that the people feel. So I think what you might see is the Iranian government will back off a bit. You know, they'll stop enriching it. They won't enrich uranium to the same level. Waiting, you know, for a time when the world is looking elsewhere, and then they'll move in and do it again. I think the world has to be vigilant on this thing continuously for years to come, because I really do think that this thing will schlep on for some time. And unfortunately, you're not going to wake up and everything will be over. Yes.
What's the current status of the Jonathan Pollard discussions, negotiations?
Right. Look, Jonathan Pollard is a tragic and a weird situation. And I think that this is a case where we really don't have the information. We really don't know what's involved. I'm speaking personally, and this is, no, I don't have any inside information. I do not believe America is an anti-Semitic country. I don't think there's institutional anti-Semitism here. I don't think that, there might be scattered anti-Semites in key positions in the Defense Department or the State Department, but institutionally I don't think this is, you know, this anti-Semitism involved here. So you have to ask yourself the question, why? Why are they holding this guy for so long when other people doing a lot worse things, or what we think were a lot worse things, are out and about free? And I think the situation is, we in Israel have been led to believe that this is a one-off deal. That Jonathan Pollard spied, he was involved on his own, a one-off deal, it's only him. That was where we were coming to the story. I don't think the U.S. has come to the story from the same place. I think the U.S. believes that he wasn't alone, that there were other guys out there involved, either high up in the U.S. government or high up in the Israeli government, and they want names. And I think that's one of the reasons they've kept him so long as they have and haven't shown him any clemency. And I think, I mean, what brought this home to me was about 5 years ago, they arrested some guy, some old, also a guy, I think he worked in the Navy intelligence as well, in New Jersey, an old Jewish guy. And they were tapping his phone to Israel, you know, 20 years after the Pollard affair, right? And phone calls he was making to somebody who was involved in the Pollard affair in Israel. Why are you tapping a guy's phone 20 years after the incident if you believe that the incident is over and was done? And I don't think that they do. I don't think the Americans think it's over. Look, also, we don't know. We don't have the information to judge it. Personally, I don't see a situation where Obama is going to release him. There was a golden opportunity in 1998, I think, when Bibi was negotiating the Y Accords, and Clinton, as a sweetener to Israel, right? Because Israel was giving up a lot there in Hebron, and Bibi needed something to take back to Israel. This is what I got, and they were willing to throw in. Clinton was willing to throw in Pollard into the mix, and George Tenet, who was the CIA director at the time, who isn't an anti-Semite, right? He stood up and said, if you do this, I'm resigning. So I think there's a lot more to the story than we actually know. But again, this is not to mitigate the human tragedy of the guy who sat in jail for 26 years.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.